Chapter 6. Institutionalized. Join 'em, leave 'em, or take 'em down. Warning. This chapter contains spoilers for the following books. The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. The Outsiders by S. E. Hinton. The Color Purple by Alice Walker. The Giver by Lois Lowry. The Help by Catherine Stockett. It's your first day of middle school. You enter the cafeteria, gripping your tray like it's a life raft, searching for a place to sit, a place to belong. You see two options: an empty seat at the cool kids' table, or an entire table all to yourself. You know this is a choice that might define you for the rest of the year, maybe even the rest of your life. What do you do? Do you join the group, or do you forge a path alone? Does this terrifying scenario sound familiar to anyone? Just me? Okay, moving on. The question, to join or not to join, is at the heart of every institutionalized story. These are the novels that spotlight groups of people and the ultimate choice whether to be a card-carrying member of the group or go it alone. And the answer isn't always easy. Institutions or groups come in every different size and shape. They can be as small as a family, like the one in Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, or as large as a whole town or city, like the town of Macomb, Alabama, in To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, or the city of Jackson, Mississippi in the early 1960s in The Help by Catherine Stockett. They can even be subsections of society, like the world of the greasers and socias in The Outsiders by S. E. Hinton, the world of rich 1920s Long Islanders in The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald, or the world of the patriarchy in 1930s Georgia in The Color Purple by Alice Walker. Institutions can also be fictional, made-up establishments, like the theocratic society depicted in The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, the deceivingly idyllic community in The Giver by Lois Lowry, or the dystopian world under the rule of the party in 1984 by George Orwell. Finally, institutionalized stories can even center around a unifying issue, event, or thematic element, like modern motherhood, as spotlighted by the three main characters of Big Little Lies by Leanne Moriarty, life under the rule of Henry VIII, as spotlighted by the three main characters in The Boleyn Inheritance by Philippa Gregory, or The American Dream, as spotlighted by the eight featured characters in The Joy Luck Club by Amy Tan. The number one indicator of an institutionalized novel is that the story is about the many, not necessarily the one. Even in the case of single narrators, as in The Great Gatsby, The Outsiders, or The Handmaid's Tale, these stories are more about the larger group the hero inhabits and the hero's relationship with that group than they are about the hero's solo journey. In The Great Gatsby, we see the story through the eyes of a newcomer, Nick Carraway. But his life is far less interesting than the lives of the people he gets involved with, namely Jay Gatsby and Daisy and Tom Buchanan. In The Outsiders, Ponyboy is our eyes into this fraught world between the greasers and the socias, and he's the character that changes the most. But there's a reason the title of the novel is plural. No matter which institution you choose to highlight, the essential ingredients of a successful institutionalized story are 1. A group. 2. A choice. And 3. A sacrifice. Let's look at what we're dealing with. The groups featured in institutionalized stories are those we're either born into, brought into, often against our will, or asked to join. Regardless of size, when done right, these institutions can feel like the whole world to the characters inside them and outside them. And the stories that fit into this wide-ranging genre usually present a centralized deliberation for the hero or heroes about the pros and cons of being one of the gang. While at the same time, the author of an institutionalized novel must explore the gang itself. What is this world about? Who are its members? What are its rules? And how easy is it to lose yourself inside this group? We readers can relate easily to stories about groups. Human beings have been part of groups from the beginning. We're born into families. We join cliques at school. We get jobs at companies. We become members of communities. We're weighing the pros and cons of groups every day of our lives. Institutionalized stories are primal because, biologically, we're programmed to flock together. As primitive humans, we died if we tried to venture out to face the woolly mammoth alone. But as we evolved as a species, we began to wonder whether venturing out alone and forging our own path is the better option. Which is why when we read institutionalized stories, we start asking ourselves questions that lie at the very heart of being human. Can we really trust others to have our best interests at heart? Or does there come a point when we must rely on ourselves? And which one is crazier, the group or me for leaving it? Therein lies the origin of the name of this genre, institutionalized. As we readers dive further into the world that you, the author, have set up for us, we should be seeing a little bit of the crazy that lies within all groups and families. Because the group dynamic is often crazy, and sometimes even self-destructive. Herd mentality can defy all logic and reason. Being loyal to a group often contradicts common sense, sometimes even survival, but we still do it. And when we join the many, we often lose a piece of ourselves. So you, the author of an institutionalized story, have a fairly tricky task on your hands. Honoring the institution you've introduced to us, while at the same time exposing the problems of losing one's identity to it. As you peel back the layers of your establishment and reveal to us what makes it tick, we readers should be asking ourselves, what would I do in the hero's shoes? Would I join or not? Would I stay or go? That is the choice at the heart of every institutionalized story, and our second ingredient for succeeding in this genre. To better understand this choice and ingredient, let's take a look at three common character types that tend to appear in institutionalized stories. The primary hero of the story, or one of them in the case of multiple heroes, is often a newcomer to the institution, endearingly dubbed the naïf. When this is the case, the naïf is usually introduced to the institution by someone more experienced, someone to show them the ropes and introduce them to this new and unfamiliar world tucked within the great big world. In Big Little Lies by Leanne Moriarty, for example, one of the heroes, Jane, is a naïf who gets taken under the wing of Madeline as she steps into the institution of elementary school moms in a posh area of Sydney, Australia. In The Help by Catherine Stockett, Skeeter is our naïf, because even though she's lived in Jackson, Mississippi her whole life, it's not until she teams up with Abilene and Minnie to tell the stories of The Help that she truly realizes what kind of institution she's been living in. Naïfs are often used as the reader's eyes into the world. As they learn the rules, so do we. And it can be especially helpful to have a character like this to ease the reader into the world without the use of too much exposition, aka info dumping. But not all institutionalized stories feature a naïf character. Some novels are told through the point of view of another type of character called the Brando. Named after the notoriously rebellious actor Marlon Brando, these types of characters are existing members of the featured establishment. They're already entrenched in the system, but they're starting to doubt it. Or perhaps they've doubted it for years, but what can they do? They're stuck. This is their world, and the idea of leaving it seems crazy at first. These are characters like Winston in 1984, Abilene in The Help, Jonas in The Giver, Ponyboy in The Outsiders, Will in Long Way Down by Jason Reynolds, Montag in Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury, and Celie in The Color Purple. When the novel begins, there's already something different about these characters. They don't exactly fit in. They stand opposed to the system by their very nature. But it isn't until we get into the heart of the story that we see them actually acting on their doubts. Naiffs and Brandos both have the important role of revealing the flaws of the institution you've chosen to write about by being either an outsider, Naiff, or a rebellious insider, Brando. But both ultimately accomplish this task by going up against the third character common in institutionalized stories, the company man. This character embodies the system or institution. They buy into it. They are rah-rah cheerleaders for it. They're not just a part of it. They will usually defend it to the death. As authors of institutionalized tales, we rely on these characters to reveal the crazy of this world. This is what happens to you when you buy into this institution wholeheartedly and without any reservations. Memorable company man characters include O'Brien in 1984, Aunt Lydia, or all the aunts, really, in The Handmaid's Tale, and Hilly Holbrook in The Help. Because of their unwavering loyalty to the establishment, these kinds of characters tend to come off as insane, or sometimes even strangely robotic. They've traded a little piece of their soul for the safety they craved within the system. They kind of have to feel a little off. Otherwise, how else would they be able to cling so tightly to an institution that you, the author, are trying to poke holes in? The company man represents one side of that fateful choice that all institutionalized heroes must make. Stick with the group or get the heck out of Dodge. And that choice often gets more difficult as the novel progresses. Loyalty and resolve are tested as the Brando or Naiff, or both, gets more entrenched in the drama of the institution and its seemingly crazy rules. But ultimately, all institutionalized stories end with the third genre ingredient, a sacrifice. Heroes either join the system, 1984, burn it down, The Help, The Outsiders, The Giver, or escape from it, The Handmaid's Tale, The Great Gatsby, The Color Purple. The escape can also be a suicide, both literal or figurative. Regardless of the ending, the hero's sacrifice serves as a cautionary tale about the dangers of entering into an institution. In the end, the deeper message is about listening to your inner voice. Yes, we all need to be part of some type of group to survive, but it's our individual human spirit, the thing that makes us who we are, that we ultimately must nurture and protect. Beware the group. Be yourself. To recap, if you're thinking of writing an institutionalized novel, make sure your story includes these three essential ingredients. A group, a family, organization, business, community, or uniting issue that is unique and interesting. A choice, an ongoing conflict between the Naiff and or Brando and the company man, usually revolving around the question to join or not to join for a Naiff, or to stay or not to stay for a Brando. A sacrifice leading to one of three possible endings: join, burn it down, or escape, including suicide. Popular institutionalized novels through time include The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne, Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, Montana Sky by Nora Roberts. Red Rising by Pierce Brown. For a complete list, please refer to the bonus PDF that came with this audiobook. Here is the beat sheet for The Help by Catherine Stockett. Save the Cat genre, institutionalized. Book genre, historical fiction. Total pages, 522. Berkeley Paperback Edition, 2009. This poignant historical fiction novel by Catherine Stockett is a shining example of how an author can successfully balance multiple heroes in one story. The Help centers around three protagonists, Abilene, Minnie, and Skeeter. And as you'll hear from this beat sheet, each character has her own set of beats, some overlapping and some unique to the character. If you're looking to write a novel with multiple perspectives, multiple main characters, or both, this is a great one to study. But just as Catherine Stockett has done, it's still important to decide upfront who is the hero of the story. Who has the biggest transformative journey ahead of them? In The Help, while Minnie and Skeeter play important roles and each experience their own emotional arcs, it is arguably Abilene who changes the most, thereby making her the primary hero of this harrowing and heartwarming tale about three women who take on the segregated and racist institution of The Help in Jackson, Mississippi in the 1960s. 1. Opening image, Abilene. Pages 1 to 2. In the first chapter, we're introduced to the first of our three heroes and one of our Brando characters, Abilene, a black maid working for a white family in Jackson in 1962. We're given a glimpse of Abilene's life and the institution of domestic help in 1960s Mississippi under the racial segregation laws of Jim Crow. Abilene has raised 17 white kids in her lifetime. Her current employer, Miss Elizabeth Leifold, seems to want nothing to do with her own child, May Mobley, who Abilene says is her special baby. 2. Theme stated, Abilene. Page 12. While Skeeter, another of our three heroes and our naive character, is at Miss Leifold's house for Bridge Club, she secretly asks Abilene, "Do you ever wish you could change things?" Page 12. This is the primary theme of the novel, finding the courage to change an institution that is corrupt and unjust. And Abilene is the furthest from learning that theme of any of the three heroes. Which is why in her head she responds, "That's one of the stupidest questions I ever heard." And then to Skeeter, she says, "Oh no, ma'am, everything's fine." Page 12. As we'll soon see, however, everything is not fine. But Abilene is not prepared to do anything about it. Yet. 3. Setup, Abilene. Pages 2 through 35. We learn that Abilene's son, Treelore, died on a lumber mill job site getting crushed by a tractor, and she observes that, "It weren't long before I seen something in me had changed. A bitter seed was planted inside of me, and I just didn't feel so accepting anymore." Page 35. This bitterness is a stasis equals death moment for Abilene. Something must change. She must change. Otherwise, the bitterness might eat her alive. As the ladies play bridge, we meet the novel's company man, Miss Hilly Holbrook, who won't use the bathroom in Miss Leifold's house because it's the same bathroom that the help uses. Hilly mentions the bill she's working on, a home help sanitation initiative, which requires every white home to have a separate bathroom for the help. That evening, Abilene goes home and talks to her best friend Minnie, our third hero and the other Brando character. She warns her that Hilly has accused her of stealing, something she overheard at the Bridge Club meeting. We soon learn that Hilly fired Minnie for reasons not revealed to the reader. 4. Catalyst, Minnie, page 17. When Abilene warns Minnie that Hilly might accuse her of stealing, this becomes Minnie's catalyst, even though it's still being told from Abilene's point of view. 5. Debate, Minnie, pages 17 through 35. Can she get another job? That is the debate question for Minnie. Minnie starts asking around for more work, but no one will hire her, revealing another aspect of this institution. Once the company man accuses you of stealing, no one will trust you. As Minnie starts to worry that she may never find another job again, Celia Foote, a new woman in town, calls Miss Leifold, asking for a reference for a new maid. Abilene answers the phone and gives her Minnie's name and number, lying to Celia about the recommendation coming from Miss Leifold. 6. Break into 2, Minnie, pages 36 to 45. We switch to Minnie's point of view, just as she shows up for her job interview at Celia Foote's house. She really needs this job. Minnie knows the real reason Hilly is spreading rumors about her is because of a terrible, awful thing she did to Hilly, which Minnie won't reveal to us yet. Immediately we realize that Celia Foote is the polar opposite of Hilly Holbrook, and different from the other white women in the institution. For starters, she's nice to Minnie, which Minnie can't believe is genuine. She thinks Celia is playing with her. But she gets the job, at twice the pay of her last job. The only catch? Celia asks Minnie to keep this a secret from her husband Johnny, who thinks Celia can take care of the house herself. Minnie agrees, but makes Celia promise to tell Johnny by Christmas. 7. B story, Minnie, pages 37 to 47. The B story character for Minnie is Celia Foote, her new employer. Minnie has been hardened by her work as a maid, and she's distanced herself from her employers. She doesn't trust them. Celia Foote is different, though. She will teach Minnie that not all employers are the same, and eventually Minnie will even grow to care about Celia Foote. On page 45, Minnie flashes back to the day she turned 14 and was first put to work as a maid. Her mother told her the hard and fast rules for working in a white lady's house institution. One being, white people are not your friends. Page 46. This is the paradigm Minnie has believed all of her life. This is also a theme stated for Minnie. She lives rigidly by the rules of this institution. She buys into the hard lines between black and white. But Celia Foote is different. She quickly proves to be colorblind. She will show Minnie that the lines exist only in her head. 8. Fun and Games, Minnie, pages 45 to 226. Minnie starts work and is immediately suspicious of Celia, who lives in this giant house by herself with no kids, lounges around a lot, and is always sneaking off upstairs. She tries to teach Celia to cook at Celia's request, but it's a lost cause. She tries to get Celia out of the house so she can clean it, but Celia says none of the girls in town will return her calls. 3. Setup, Skeeter, pages 62 to 83. We leave Minnie and switch to Skeeter's perspective for a while as Skeeter drives home to her family's cotton plantation in Longleaf. She thinks about what went down at the bridge club that day and how she, Hilly, and Elizabeth, Miss Leifold, have been friends since elementary school, but now they're growing apart. She and Hilly went to university together, but Hilly left to get married while Skeeter stayed. Skeeter is stuck inside her own institution, the institution of young Southern white women in the 1960s. Everyone expects them to get married. No one expects them to work. But Skeeter wants to be a writer. I think about how things are different between Hilly and me since I came home from school. But who is the different person, her or me? Page 64. This is the kind of question posed in almost all institutionalized stories. Who's crazier, them for joining or me for wanting to leave? When she gets home, she's immediately hounded by her mother about trying harder to find a husband and get married, and she has a stasis equals death moment when she narrates, "I shudder with the same left-behind feeling I've had since I graduated from college 3 months ago. I've been dropped off in a place I do not belong anymore." Page 65. As Skeeter looks for a job in anything writing-related, she thinks about her own black maid, Constantine, who raised her and who Skeeter feels closer to than her own mother. Constantine left the family under mysterious circumstances while Skeeter was away at college. Skeeter wants to try to track her down, but no one will give her any details about her new address. In these pages, we learn more about Skeeter's status quo life. She wants to be a writer. She applied for a job at a publishing company but hasn't heard back. Her mother doesn't know about her true life aspirations. 2. Theme stated, Skeeter, page 73. In a flashback, Skeeter remembers Constantine saying, "Ever morning, until you dead in the ground, you gone have to make this decision. You gone have to ask yourself, am I gone believe what them fools say about me today?" The choice for Skeeter and her theme is whether to blaze her own trail and disregard what others think. 4. Catalyst, Skeeter, page 83. Skeeter receives a letter from Elaine Stein at Harper & Row Publishers, turning down Skeeter's application for an editor job because she has no experience. Elaine advises Skeeter to get an entry-level job at her local newspaper. But the best piece of advice Elaine gives her is to write about what disturbs you, particularly if it bothers no one else. Page 83. Elaine Stein is telling Skeeter to question the institution. Then Elaine adds a handwritten note, offering to read Skeeter's best ideas and give feedback. 5. Debate, Skeeter, pages 84 to 142. What will she do with this offer? That is Skeeter's debate question. Skeeter immediately mails a letter to Elaine with some ideas and quickly realizes that they are ideas she thinks Elaine will find impressive, not ideas that really interest her. She then takes Elaine's advice and goes for an interview at the Jackson Journal, where she is offered a job writing the Miss Myrna column about house cleaning, which Skeeter knows nothing about. Skeeter convinces Elizabeth Leifold to let her interview Abilene about cleaning advice. During their first interview, Skeeter asks Abilene about Constantine, and Abilene reveals that Constantine was fired, but won't say more than that. Back home, Skeeter's mom admits that she did fire Constantine, but won't say why. Abilene and Skeeter bond a little when Skeeter tells Abilene about Ms. Stein's letter, and Abilene tells Skeeter about her son, who had wanted to be a writer before he died. As predicted, Skeeter gets a response from Elaine Stein, saying her ideas are flat, and asks her not to write again until she finds something more original. All of this talk about Constantine getting fired, separate bathrooms, and Abilene's son who died inspires Skeeter with an idea. She knows it's a dangerous idea that crosses the line, but the idea won't leave her alone. 4. Catalyst, Abilene, pages 105 to 119. A series of mini catalysts go off like little bombs in Abilene's status quo world. First, Abilene uses her newly built bathroom in the garage as a model for Mae Mobley, who's being potty trained. Mae Mobley won't go in the toilet in the house, but after seeing Abilene using her bathroom, she goes in Abilene's toilet. Miss Leifold comes home and spanks Mae Mobley for using the help's bathroom, saying it's dirty in there and she'll catch diseases. Then comes the 3-year anniversary of Abilene's son's death, followed by Robert Brown, the son of one of Abilene's friends, getting beaten with a tire iron for using a white bathroom. But the big catalyst, the one that will finally push Abilene to do something to change the status quo, comes when Skeeter shows up at Abilene's house and asks to interview Abilene for a book she wants to write about what it's like to work as a maid in Jackson, Mississippi. She has an idea to interview other maids as well and write from a brand new perspective. She swears they'll keep it a secret so no one gets in trouble. 5, debate, Abilene, pages 119 to 142. Will Abilene agree to participate in the book? A third debate question is posed. Abilene immediately shoots the idea down, saying it sounds too dangerous. But previous events are playing in her subconscious. Abilene knows the institution is wrong, but will she be brave enough to fix it? 5. Debate continued, Skeeter, pages 84 to 142. Skeeter is in a tough place. Abilene has turned her down for the interview, but she already wrote to Elaine Stein in New York, pitching the idea and lying that she had a maid interested in participating. Elaine Stein liked the idea and said she would read it, but now Skeeter has no one to interview. At Bridge Club, Skeeter watches Hilly force Abilene to thank her for her new bathroom. Skeeter is sickened by it and thinks, "It's no wonder she doesn't want to talk to me," page 129. She's starting to get it, seeing the institution with new eyes. Meanwhile, Hilly convinces Skeeter to go on a blind date with Stuart, a friend of Hilly's husband. The date goes horribly. Stuart is drunk and rude, insulting Skeeter every chance he gets. Skeeter's own institution, Women and Marriage, is looking pretty shoddy right now, too. 6. Break into 2. Abilene and Skeeter. Pages 142 to 143. Abilene calls Skeeter and agrees to do the interview. She may even know a few other maids who might be willing to do it, too. They agree to meet at Abilene's house because it's safest. When Skeeter asks what changed Abilene's mind, she replies simply, "Miss Hilly," page 143. 8. Fun and Games Continued, Minnie, pages 45 to 226. Minnie is tired of being scared that Celia's husband is going to come home and kill her when he finds out Celia secretly hired a maid. She keeps trying to convince Celia to tell Johnny, reminding her of their agreed-upon deadline, December 25th. Minnie finds out Abilene agreed to tell her stories to Skeeter and thinks she's crazy. Minnie vows she will never do it. One day, Minnie shows up for work, and Celia is very upset and holed up in her bathroom. She sends Minnie away without an explanation. Another day, while Minnie is cleaning the bathroom, Johnny comes home holding an axe. Minnie is certain he's going to kill her. But actually, he's very nice and tells Minnie he knew Celia had hired help. Minnie's awesome cooking gave her away. He says he's worried about Celia and just wants her to be happy. He tells Minnie to let Celia keep pretending she hasn't hired help. 8. Fun and Games, Abilene and Skeeter, pages 167 to 289. Abilene and Skeeter do the first interview. Abilene tries to tell Skeeter about herself, but she's too nervous and constrained. It doesn't go well. She's so scared about what she's doing that she vomits. Skeeter shows her qualities as a naive on the way home, feeling stupid for thinking she could just waltz in there and demand answers. This is clearly more dangerous and serious than she thought. The institution is becoming clearer to her. Days later, they try again, and Abilene says she wants to write the stories and read them to Skeeter. She thinks that will be easier. Skeeter isn't too thrilled about this, thinking she'll have to rewrite them all. But after hearing Abilene read her first story, Skeeter realizes that Abilene has serious talent and this might actually work, page 176. For the next 2 weeks, Abilene and Skeeter work on Abilene's story while pretending to be strangers at Miss Leifold's home. As the interviews continue, Skeeter's eyes are opened to the institution and the world she's lived in but never really seen before. On page 183, she remarks, "Hilly raises her voice about 3 octaves higher when she talks to colored people. Elizabeth smiles like she's talking to a child, although certainly not her own. I am starting to notice things." This is definitely an upside-down world for Skeeter. After they finish Abilene's story, Skeeter sends it off to Elaine Stein. Elaine likes the story and wants her to do 12 more by January. It seems impossible. She begs Abilene to find more maids for them to talk to. Minnie finally agrees to join in and tell her story. The 3 women settle into a routine. Minnie tells her story to Abilene, and Skeeter tries to write it all down. Meanwhile, Stuart comes by Skeeter's house, apologizes for his horrible behavior, and asks her out again. She agrees. The two have a much better date than the first and form a relationship. At the library, Skeeter finds a copy of the Jim Crow Laws of the South. She's surprised to see all of these separation laws in print. Her eyes are opened up even more about the institution that she's been practically blind to. She steals the pamphlet and puts it in her satchel, but then accidentally leaves her satchel at Hilly's house during a junior league meeting. Skeeter freaks out because the interviews with Abilene and Minnie are in there, and Hilly loves to snoop. When she goes to get the bag, Hilly is pissed. Skeeter has no idea if Hilly saw the stories, but Abilene says she doesn't want to stop working on the book regardless. Thankfully, it's soon revealed that all Hilly saw in the satchel were the Jim Crow laws, so she thinks Skeeter is against segregation. 7. B Story, Abilene and Skeeter, page 167. Abilene and Skeeter are each other's B Story characters. Through her stories, Abilene teaches Skeeter what it's really like to be a maid and what the institution looks like from the inside, while Skeeter helps Abilene find her voice and pushes her to tell her story, something she would never have done without Skeeter's book idea. The more they work on the book together, the more they bond. Abilene starts opening up more and more to Skeeter. 8. Fun and Games Continued, Minnie, pages 45 to 226. Minnie continues to clean Celia's home. Celia is still acting strangely, lying in bed all day. Celia keeps trying to get a hold of Hilly so she can hang out with her, but Hilly keeps snubbing her. Minnie is relieved. If they ever connect, Hilly will tell Celia to fire Minnie for what Minnie did to her, the terrible, awful thing that Minnie still hasn't revealed. Back at home, Minnie's husband Leroy threatens Minnie and the kids not to get involved with the civil rights movement, as it's too dangerous. Minnie realizes she's starting to care about Celia when she finds hidden alcohol and thinks Celia has been drinking. She gets mad. Minnie's father and husband are both alcoholics. Minnie and Celia argue, and Celia fires Minnie. Thanks to Abilene, Minnie also starts to realize how good she has it at Celia's house and goes to beg for her job back. When she gets there, she finds Celia in the bathroom, surrounded by blood. She's miscarried her baby. She was 5 months pregnant. This is the fourth baby she's lost. The alcohol that Minnie thought she saw was actually a tonic intended to help Celia get and stay pregnant. 9. Midpoint, All, pages 290 to 298. Skeeter finds out that Yule May, Hilly's maid, is interested in sharing her story. But then soon after, she receives a letter from Yule May explaining why she can't share her story. She's in prison because of Hilly Holbrook. Yule May and her husband had only enough money to send one of their twin sons to college, so she stole a ring from Hilly, one that Skeeter claims Hilly didn't even like, to try to make up the difference. Hilly found out and had her arrested. When Skeeter gets to Abilene's house that night, there are maids lined up to tell their stories, all angry about what Hilly did to Yule May. Skeeter and Abilene definitely have enough for their book. On page 297, Skeeter says, "My relief is bitter, that it took Yule May's internment to bring us to this." After everyone has signed up and left, Skeeter notes Minnie standing in the corner. But I see it, the flicker on her mouth, a hint of a softness beneath the anger. Minnie has made this happen. Page 298. All three characters' beat sheets merge at the midpoint as their goals to make this book happen become aligned. They will now have enough stories to submit the book to Elaine Stein in New York. It's definitely a false victory, however, because even though the women achieved their goal of getting the maids to tell their stories, the way in which the victory was achieved creates a stakes-are-raised moment when they realize how dangerous Hilly Holbrook and her kind can be if they were ever to be caught. 10. Bad Guys Close In, All, pages 298 to 420. Skeeter goes to Abilene's house every night to collect the stories. She offers to pay each maid $40, and they all donate their shares to Yule May's son's college fund. Despite this, the bad guys close in proves to be a downward path for all the women. Stuart breaks up with Skeeter because he's still in love with his ex. Skeeter's mom has been sick lately, and her mysterious condition is getting worse. Hilly demands that Skeeter put her home health sanitation initiative in the Junior League newsletter, which Skeeter edits. Skeeter refuses. Hilly threatens to get Skeeter kicked out of the league. Hilly also demands that Skeeter give back the Jim Crow laws that she stole from the library, because people can't think Skeeter is an integrationist. Otherwise, no one will support the Junior League's cause. The poor, starving people of Africa. Page 331. It's a highly ironic moment that eludes Hilly completely. Skeeter narrates, "I wait for her to catch the irony of this, that she'll send money to colored people overseas, but not across town." Page 331. This is typical company man behavior. Hilly is so entrenched in the system, so brainwashed by its rules, any illogicality escapes her. Skeeter gives in to Hilly and types up the initiative for the newsletter, wondering what Constantine, her former maid, would think of her, giving in to the pressures of others. Theme. But she accidentally mixes up verbiage from the initiative and the league's coat drive, and the newspaper is printed with the words, "Drop off your old toilets at Hilly's address," page 340. A few days later, Hilly's lawn is full of used toilets. The story gets written up in the Jackson Journal and the New York Times. Hilly disowns Skeeter as a friend and tells all their mutual friends not to talk to her. Abilene is really worried about what else Hilly, external bad guys, will do to get her revenge on Skeeter and how dangerous Hilly can be. And the anxiety is heightened when Hilly finds out that Minnie, whom she fired, has been working for Celia Foote at the fake recommendation of Elizabeth Leifold. Minnie and Abilene will both be in huge trouble if Hilly finds out Abilene lied about the recommendation. When Hilly calls Celia's house, Minnie answers and lies, telling Hilly that Minnie quit and Celia is out of town. 11. All is lost, Minnie. Pages 344 to 365. As each of the three women have to learn their own theme, the beat sheets diverge again. Minnie hits rock bottom when Leroy beats her badly, this time while he's cold stone sober. Page 359. Celia notices the cut above Minnie's eye and questions her about it, not believing Minnie's story about banging her head in the bathtub. She tries to get Minnie to talk, treating her like a friend, Minnie's theme. But their conversation is interrupted when a sex pervert intruder appears in Celia's backyard, and the two women have to fight him off together. As Minnie washes her hands afterward, she wonders how an awful day could turn even worse. It seems like at some point, you just run out of awful. Page 365. 12. Dark Night of the Soul, Minnie. Pages 365 to 400. Later that night, Minnie speaks to Abilene about what happened that day. As Minnie talks about Celia, Abilene points out to Minnie that it almost sounds like you care, page 367. But Minnie insists she's just upset because Celia doesn't see the lines between people. Abilene repeats Minnie's theme, assuring her that the lines don't exist. The institution has convinced Minnie to believe in something that's not there. On page 368, Abilene says to Minnie, "All I'm saying is, kindness don't have no boundaries." Minnie explains to Celia why Hilly doesn't like Celia, because Hilly used to date Johnny. And Celia decides she's going to try to talk to Hilly about it at the upcoming Junior League benefit. Minnie thinks that's a bad idea. The annual benefit takes place and everyone is there. Abilene and Minnie are serving, and Skeeter is a guest, although she's still shunned by all of her friends, at Hilly's behest. The auction winners for the baked goods are announced, and Hilly wins Minnie's famous chocolate pie. For some reason, this angers Hilly, and she accuses a drunk Celia of signing her up for the pie. Celia is confused by the attack. She tries to explain that Johnny didn't cheat on Hilly with her. but in her drunken state, she accidentally tears Hilly's dress, then vomits on the carpet. 13. Break into 3, Minnie, pages 395 to 402. Celia is upset about what happened at the benefit and doesn't understand why Hilly is mad at her. Minnie proves she's learned her theme and, in a gesture of true friendship, tells Celia everything that happened between Hilly and her. She explains that after Hilly accused Minnie of being a thief, Hilly told her to eat my shit, page 398. Then she baked her a chocolate pie as a peace offering, and only after Hilly had eaten 2 slices did she tell Hilly that she'd baked her own feces into the pie. Celia thanks Minnie for telling her the story, and the next day she's feeling better and working in the garden. Celia writes a check to the Junior League, and in the memo line she's written, "For 2 slice Hilly," page 402. Their friendship is sealed. 10. Bad Guys Close In Continued, Skeeter, pages 298 to 420. Elaine pushes up the deadline on the manuscript and tells Skeeter that she needs to have a section in the book about Skeeter's own maid, Constantine, which means Skeeter really has to find out what happened to her. Meanwhile, Skeeter continues to feel the effects of Hilly's snub when she gets voted out as the editor of the Junior League newsletter. Skeeter tries to convince herself she doesn't care and instead throws herself into working on the book. When the book is nearly finished, the 3 women decide to title it Help. 11. All is Lost, Skeeter, pages 420 to 430. Thanks to Abilene, Skeeter finds out the truth about Constantine. Her mother fired her after her daughter talked back and spit in her face. Constantine and her daughter left, and Constantine died 3 weeks later. Whiff of death. 12. Dark Night of the Soul, Skeeter, pages 430 to 447. The book is now finished, but Abilene, Skeeter, and Minnie are worried about people figuring out the city in the stories is Jackson, even though they changed all the names and called the city Niceville. Minnie decides they need to include the story about the chocolate pie as insurance. Hilly will automatically know the book is about Jackson, but she'll work to keep it quiet so her secret is safe. It's a huge risk, but they have to take it. Skeeter sends the manuscript to Elaine Stein, and they all wait. Later, after Skeeter learns that her mother has stomach cancer, another whiff of death, she gets back together with Stuart, returned to the familiar. 13. Break into 3, Skeeter, pages 447 to 452. Stuart proposes, and Skeeter knows she has to tell him the truth. She proves that she's learned her theme about not caring what people think of her and blazing her own trail when she tells Stuart about the book she's been working on, making sure to leave out any names. Stuart is appalled. Things are fine around here. Why would you want to go stirring up trouble? Page 449. But Skeeter stands her ground, insisting that things are not fine. Stuart withdraws his proposal, takes the ring, and leaves. 13. Break into 3, All, pages 452 to 455. Elaine Stein calls and says she wants to publish the book. All 3 heroes join in this moment of celebration and this step into the synthesis world of Act 3. They are no longer separated by the invisible lines of the institution. They are in this together. And this book being published represents the sacrifice that all of them make in an effort to burn down the institution. 14. Finale, All, pages 456 to 516. Months later, they're all wondering what's going to happen when the book is released and the people of Jackson start to read it. Abilene narrates, "Feels like we've been waiting for some invisible pot of water to boil for the past 7 months." Page 459. After the book is published, Abilene and Minnie go to church, and everyone applauds them. The Reverend hands Abilene a copy of the book, signed by every member of the church. We know you couldn't put your name on it, so we all signed our own for you. Page 467. The Reverend also has a wrapped book for the White Lady. You tell her we love her, like she's our family. Page 468. The book gets featured on TV, and people start to wonder if it's about Jackson. Hilly now has a copy, and the three women wait for her to read the final chapter about the chocolate pie. Back at work, Johnny thanks Minnie for everything she did for Celia. You'll always have a job here with us, Minnie, for the rest of your life if you want. As Hilly reads the book, she starts to think that it's about Jackson and vows to figure out which maids wrote it. She tells everyone to fire their maids, but soon changes her tune and starts insisting that the book is not about Jackson. This is when we know that she's read the pie chapter. She confronts Skeeter, knowing she was the one who contributed to the book, and threatens revenge on all the maids involved. They better watch out for what's coming to them. Page 497. Skeeter gets offered a job at Harper's Magazine in New York, but refuses to take it because she doesn't want to leave Minnie and Abilene to deal with the aftermath. But Abilene and Minnie insist she must go and live her life. 5,000 more copies of the book are printed, and Abilene gets the Miss Myrna column job, solidifying her new job as a professional writer. Minnie leaves Leroy for good after he threatens to burn down the house with her in it. 15. Final image, Abilene. Pages 516 to 522. Abilene proves she's learned her own theme when Hilly accuses her of stealing and threatens to send her to jail. Abilene finally stands up for herself, which she never would have done at the beginning. I know something about you, and don't you forget that. And from what I hear, they's a lot of time to write a lot of letters in jail. Page 519. She's fired from her job anyway, but we know she'll be all right, because she now has the Miss Myrna job and the book revenue. As she walks to the bus stop, she realizes that she can start over, even though she thought she was finished with everything new. Page 522. Apparently, people can change. Why is this an institutionalized? The Help contains all three elements of a successful institutionalized story. A group. This story is about the institution of black maids working in white families in Jackson, Mississippi, in the early 1960s. A choice. All three women face choices when it comes to the institution and what to do about its injustices. And all three women are pitted against the company man, Hilly Holbrook, in various ways. A sacrifice leading to one of three possible endings. Join, burn it down, or escape. As a whole, the three women burn down the institution in the way they expose the injustices with the book. Skeeter also chooses to leave in the end. If you'd like to read an abbreviated version of this beat sheet, check out the Cat's Eye View for The Help, which can be found in the bonus PDF.